Welcome to Lynn Cullen Live, talk radio without the static. Email your questions and comments to lynncullenshow@gmail.com. And now your host, Lynn Cullen.
And a good morning to you. It must be a Monday because I just did something really stupid. I'm essentially saying this for the benefit of my producer, Kevin. Hi, Kevin. He was starting the show, and there's no excuse. I don't know what I did. I ended up disconnecting. I turned my phone off. Why? I don't know. And lost the connection anyway. But here we are. Good God. February 19. Oh, man. Oh, it's a holiday, somebody told me. What nonsense. It was President's Day. Is that really a holiday? Really? I think I once did a very long piece on, is there apostrophe? Is there an apostrophe in President's Day? And if there is, where is it? Is it before that S? Or is it after that S? And I think this is open to, because most people don't know what the hell to do with an apostrophe anyway. I mean, it doesn't, I know, make much difference. But when I was a kid, didn't we celebrate it was George Washington's birthday? Wasn't that what it was? And then somebody added Lincoln. And then they were born like 10, I mean, many years apart, but I don't know. It's nonsense. So since we last spoke, good God in heaven, this always happens. I mean, it's what Mondays are. Good God in heaven. That's as I try to put together everything that's happened. In my head, the biggest thing that happened is the death of Navalny. Because, first of all, it was a given. I mean, the minute that man went back to Russia after they tried to poison him. That kind of courage is mind-blowing. And because we right now are living in a place and time in which courage is so often missing, it's the dearth of courage among our leaders, among ourselves, is so apparent. And his death, the death of this extraordinarily courageous man, made that so much more dark. Courage. You know, I'm going to digress here for a second. My brother, as some of you know, has written many books, even though he was a law professor. And the books are not about necessarily the law. The books are often about humans and their foibles and their emotions. And he had written a book on, probably his best known one is on disgust. It's been translated into a ton of languages. I have the Korean version. It's a riot. I mean, just because it looks so funny to me. So he wrote about disgust, and he wrote about one called humiliation. And then he set out to write one on cowardice. As you can tell, he goes for the you know, the ones that we don't talk of, that the ones that are avoided. We avoid discussions of disgust because they're disgusting. We avoid discussion of humiliation because, well, it's uncomfortable to say the least. And then, yeah, cowardice. These are all things we've all felt, disgust, our own cowardice, our own humiliations. But when my brother was writing the one about cowardice. God damn, I'm sorry. I was okay. I'm sorry. Distracted by a bird. Glorious cardinal. Wow. Anyway, he decided that it was cowardice's opposite, although I don't think he would even say it's the opposite, that was more fascinating. What is cowardice? We all have felt it, sometimes many times a day. Courage? What is that? Because that is so much more rare. And so he turned around and for the first time wrote a book about what we would consider the positive emotion of courage. And if I may, again, just one more interesting thing. He begins the book with a story about a Civil War soldier. If you're writing a book about courage, you obviously end up in a lot of wars, because that's where we often see extraordinary feats of courage. And he read a lot of letters, and the letters written by soldiers in the Civil War are just a trove of extraordinary history and humanity. And he came upon the story of one soldier, I believe a Union soldier. I hope I don't. I'll just give you the thumbnail. Who was a coward. And he was part of a company where they lined up ready to take on the enemy. And as the enemy drew closer or whatever, I don't know, this guy just cut and ran. He ran and ran and ran and ran until he couldn't run anymore. And you know, I mean, that kind of cowardice, desertion, gets you killed. Amazingly, he came back. After all his compatriots saw him run when they were putting their lives at risk, he came back. And I don't recall why they didn't kill him right away. Maybe just astonished that he'd come back, sort of like Navalny, knowing he'd be killed. And they just told him, okay, line up in the next battle. They put him right there in the front lines. When the shooting started, he ran away again. You can't make this up. I can't remember how many times the guy ran away, but he always came back. And at one point, his fellow soldiers grudgingly began to acknowledge a kind of courage in his cowardice, a courage in him It's so, so it's with that story that I know Bill, my brother, starts this book about the slipperiness of courage and cowardice. But that Alexei Navalny had courage is indisputable. Reading a lot of stuff about him, I got even more sorrowful at his loss. What an extraordinary human. I didn't know he has a daughter here studying at Stanford. His family, you know, his wife is one place. She's vowed to carry it on. His daughter's here in the United States. He, too, was in the United States studying at one point and could have stayed, could have had a nice, easy life as, you know, just another Russian dissident who can do his dissidenting from a safer place, even though Putin is known to kill you no matter where you are. So two things that that Navalny's death brings to the fore. The outrageous support of the Trump Party for Vladimir Putin, one of the most horrible humans on earth. And the fact that Putin, right now, having killed Navalny, silenced all dissent, is attempting to take over Ukraine and subject those courageous people to the same kind of horror. Because all Putin is about is repression and brutality and deceit. No wonder Donald Trump loves him. But if Navalny's death doesn't get some of the cowards in the Republican Party to stop standing in the way of aid to Ukraine in its frontline battle for democracy, which means they're proxies for us, I hope they're shamed, because they're nothing more than Putin's poodles. Everything that Navalny died for that repression, the horror of living under an autocrat, a brutal, murderous autocrat like Putin, who creates a state of constant fear. Killing Navalny was telling Russians that being brave, standing against him, go work. You end up dead. You want to be next? And that we would not, as a country, have the courage to stand behind a country that is taking on the onslaught from this murderous son of a bitch, and standing up against everything he stands for those of us in the West and our democracies. I mean, Putin will keep on going. He took Crimea. He's destabilized all those four countries that happen to share borders. And the Trump Party are his fellow travelers. The Trump Party, whose real defining characteristic is cowardice. Cowardice. Here's something Ann Applebaum said that I thought was good. She said, even behind bars, Navalny was a real threat to Putin because he was living proof that courage is possible, that truth exists, that Russia could be a different kind of country. For a dictator who survives thanks to lies and violence, that kind of challenge was intolerable. But now Putin will be forced to fight against Navalny's memory. And that is a battle he will never win. And one other thing. I don't know if you saw the video that was taken the day before he died, because the day before he died, he was in court again. Probably they were adding another 10 years onto a sentence. Who knows? But he looked good. He didn't look sick. He didn't look like a man who was going to drop dead taking a walk. And he was laughing. He was laughing. And one of the ways he showed his courage and contempt for Putin was by ridiculing him and his system, by laughing in Putin's face. Maybe, who knows, it was that he laughed in that courtroom and taunted the system yet again that drove Putin out of his mind, and he said, kill him. Who knows? But in all the reading I did, the one that blew me away is that when he got on that airplane to fly back to Russia, after they had tried to kill him, it was 2021. He sat next to his wife on the plane, and they watched an episode of Rick and Morty. Now, if you don't know Rick and Morty, it's an animated, I wouldn't know it, but I lived with a younger person who so to this day sometimes comes over and we watch some Rick and Morty. Rick and Morty, it's an outrageous, I don't know, was it on the movie? Check it out. It's a wild animated series. It involves a mad scientist, okay? And here's the thing I did not. First of all, I was blown away that he's going back to certain imprisonment and he's watching Rick and Morty. And then it turns out a month later, you know, he gets arrested of course. A month later, he's in the Russian kangaroo court. And he quoted Rick and Morty. And here's the quote. He stood up in front of that Russian court and said, "To live is to risk it all. Otherwise, you are just an inert chunk of randomly assembled molecules drifting wherever the universe blows you." Alexei Navalny, quoting Rick and Morty in the trial that would get him imprisoned and then eventually killed. Just remarkable. Okay. The other big thing, I sat glued to my television. Did you? Thursday and Friday, watching an Atlanta courtroom. God, can't get out of the courtrooms. And this, as somebody suggested, was a truly riveting, infuriating, mind-blowing piece of very American entertainment. Somebody suggested it was like a cross between My Cousin Vinny and The Real Housewives of Atlanta. And it was prosecutor DA, the district attorney, Fonnie Willis, taking the stand. Well, this, you couldn't, is it going on again today? I suppose it is. It's not over. This was the most mind-blowingly unbelievable, ridiculous, time-wasting stunt. And of course, brought to you by Donald Trump in his efforts to stay out of prison himself, to slow down the wheels of justice, an effort to get rid of this woman who was coming for him. And man, she handed him a gift. But her performance on the stand was riveting. You couldn't, if you missed it, I'm sorry. I mean, she wasn't supposed to take the stand. She comes blowing into the courtroom, just looking like she was going to explode, and says, "I want to testify." I mean, you don't see drama like that. And then flat out calling this disgusting lawyer for one of Trump's co-defendants a liar. She called her a liar to her face a number of times. It was something. And then the next day, her father was on the stand, and he was amazing. Amazing. But all of that begs the question. I don't know how this smart cookie, well, she ain't perfect, put everything in jeopardy for, well, that human libido, I'm telling you, or just human loneliness. I don't know. But I want to share with you two things written by lawyers in letters to the New York Times about this, and I really thought both expressed my feelings. This one particularly. I'm baffled by the Fonnie Willis love life issue and the immense media coverage. I've practiced law for over 50 years and never seen a dispute involving whether two lawyers on the same side of the case were intimate. No doubt this has occurred multiple times, in many cases, and it was never a concern. What business is it of Donald Trump's or the courts? Maybe the state might be concerned if its DA hired someone because of a personal relationship, but that's between the state and Ms. Willis. It doesn't affect Mr. Trump's right to a fair trial at all. There. Here's the other one. To me, a person who met her husband at work, whose parents met at work, and whose paternal and maternal grandparents met at work, this dating relationship of the Fulton County DA Fonnie Willis and the special prosecutor seems like the most natural thing in the world. As an attorney, I have difficulty finding the conflict of interest here. Ms. Willis is single. She's enjoying the company of a coworker and colleague. As we know, propinquity has led to love since antiquity. Wow! I had to get to that line. Propinquity, there's a word, guys. You don't hear it used often, but boy, is it dead on right here. It means to be near. We're it's not used because it's hard to say, and I can't even think of a sentence. So here's the sentence. Propinquity has led to love since antiquity. What? It's just a poem. Anyway, this woman goes on to say the same thing the other guy said. There might be a conflict of interest if the special prosecutor were a defense attorney, but they're working together on the same side with the same goal. And of course, the greatest irony is that a sexual predator, a known adulterer, a rapist is the one who's bringing these charges and attempting to discredit and disqualify these two unattached, hardworking professionals who happen to be dating each other. God. Okay. But here's the thing that most blew me away as she was questioned and her father was questioned. Now, we've heard often that, you know, like Jack Smith and the judges in Trump trials have gotten death threats and have to have security and all that kind of stuff. And it's become so common that we don't really take that information in. Oh, yeah, sure. Of course. No. It's sort of in this court case under questioning, the Trump lawyers constantly were trying to get her to admit that, you know, they needed to know where was she living and did what's his name ever visit her there and blah, 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 blah. So there's all this stuff about where she was and what house and this and that. And so in the course of that questioning, it came up that she had to abandon her home, a home she had bought, a new home, her dream home, bought and paid for with her hard-earned money. And she had to abandon it because the threats, and as they proceeded to talk about the threats, were mind-blowing. At one point, I mean, she's getting death threats 20 a day, right? One, though, was so specific that security people around her said, you got it. Okay, this is this one. We got to get you out of here. And this was not her house. This was in her own office. And she was put in a disguise and gotten out of the office as somebody else. And then a body double wearing a bulletproof vest, speaking of courage, pretended to be her and offered up herself as a target if this death threat was in fact legitimate. As is so often the case, no, they're about terror. Terrorizing a person, terrorizing them so her father was so scared, he told, you got to get out of the house, I'll stay. And he talked about how, you know, he was always looking over his shoulder, looking out windows, making sure they had constant security around them. She couldn't move without security around her. Would you like to live that way? And this is because she had the gall to bring charges against Donald Trump. David French has a piece today in the New York Times about how this Trump's, I call them brown shirts. Now, Trump's brown shirts, this is the, you know, the Nazi, this is Hitler's way of doing it too. You come in and you exert force, power. You project power and fear and terror. How many Republican Congress people have said they're not running again? You know, it's the list is getting really long. And these are people who voted for Trump and probably would vote for him again. But you know what? They're just getting scared and they want to get out. They don't want to be quite so close to the front lines. Who would run for office in a climate like this? Who would serve in this position of district attorney? And if you were, who would have the courage to bring charges against people that will kill you? So you create, Putin understands this, you create this climate of intimidation and fear, knowing that most people do not have a lot of courage. One of the people who came to the stand on Friday was the former governor of Georgia. And am I forgetting his name? Boy, was he a classic Southern pal. He was back in the day when they still elected Democrats. He was a Democrat. And he came to the stand because he wanted to make clear that he had been her first choice to come on as special prosecutor. So she had brought him in and made that offer to him. And he turned her down. And he turned her down because he said to her, "Hey, do I want to spend the rest of my life having to have bodyguards around me night and day?" So here's a guy who knows the reality. And he said, "I'm not taking this on because I don't want to live with to be in some, you know, somebody's sights." And he talked about the fact that there had been death threats he'd had in the past as governor, how he thought it was one thing or the other. And then he, just an aside, he happened to mention that one guy who was a credible source of some terror for him was saying he was going to kill him because he was too close to the Jews. So, this is what Donald Trump has brought to our country. This was not something that we have seen in our lives before. People afraid. People afraid to serve on a school board. People afraid to help an election happen. To sit there at a polling place and make sure people get their ballots and are registered. These were not positions where people felt they were putting their lives on the line. They are now. When the Colorado Supreme Court decided that Donald Trump should not be on their primary ballot, every one of those justices, good God, the threats started. And now they live in this Trumpian terror. Every witness, every juror in all of these cases against, against Trump will live with this kind of terror. We know that some of the votes against Ukraine aid, for instance, are made by Republican Congress people who are afraid. Because there are enough Trump cultists who understand their role and that their role is to be an intimidator of anyone who goes astray. And every Republican congressman has more than one of these people in their district. David French writes that the intimidation is systemic and ubiquitous, an acknowledged tactic in the playbook of the Trump world. So this is where we've come, and I realized that as I watched Fannie Willis and her dad talk about the reality of their lives and the impact, I look at her in an entirely different way. What a brave woman. And you think the attorney general in New York State, who successfully brought the case against Trump's businesses, that $450 million now he's going to be on the hook for? What do you think her life's like? And you look at, you have to, two black women who have the balls. Two black women. The white guys are saying, "No, thanks, I'll take a pass." And that's how you get autocracies. Lack of courage. I think it was his name Bruni who was writing a thing about, because he likes words, you know, I like words. Propinquity! He was writing about how Trump has also shown that our language is not up to the task of describing him. I mean, many a time, as you know, I mean, I keep using the same words over and over and over again. And Bruni says, we do our best, but finding words, you know, essentially synonyms for worst, stumps us. He says our society needs front pages beyond the usual front pages, superlatives beyond the usual superlatives. I so agree with this. It's why I'm so angry at the newspapers for just doing the same old when we are not in the same old. He says we need a thesaurus to supplement the thesaurus. Trump tests more than our sanity. He tests the very limits of language. Demagogue, autocrat, dictator, tyrant. So many of us have used and reused those terms with good reason. So when his malevolence metastasizes, what? Where do we go then? What's left to say? The usual pejoratives don't cut it. Yeah, I know. Wow. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for sniffing in your ear. Okay, a few quickies. Things. Oh, Yammer Yager. Guys. Boy, was that a love fest all weekend. For those of you who don't know, Yammer Yager was a Penguin hockey player. He's still playing hockey. He's in his 50s. He plays in his native land, Czechoslovakia, for a team he owns. And I'm sure he's still the best guy on the ice. But I spent the week, much of the weekend, distracting myself with, there was so many really good, videos and pieces out about his time here. What fun. And they retired his, jersey, yesterday, here in Pittsburgh. And it's just nice. That's all I want to say. Just really nice. Makes you smile. Yeah. And I mean, you don't even have to be a hockey fan. You also don't have to be a hockey fan when they show some of his, some of him on the ice to realize how he's skating circles around all those other professionals on the ice. It's pretty amazing. Wonderful. Okay. So that said, you know, this happens. You, in reading, as I do, and you do, I'm sure, you come on just little things, little tidbits of stuff, and you're, you think, wow, I didn't know that. So I have to share some of, here's some little things I discovered inadvertently while reading this in the last 3 days. Did you ever see a movie, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I happened to rewatch it the other day. Man, that thing is good. Director Mike Nichols, I think that was his first film. Also, you know what I didn't know is another one of my favorite movies, North by Northwest, which is Hitchcock. The same guy who wrote that script wrote the script for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, adapted Edward Albee's play. And that guy is brilliant. His name is Ernest Lehman. We should know that guy's name. Anyway, but that's not the one. So in this, it turns out that when Albee agreed, the playwright, to let Warner Brothers make his play into a film, he agreed after Jack Warner, the head of the studio, promised him that Martha, the character that Liz Taylor plays, would be played by Betty Davis, and that George, the actor that the part Richard Burton played, would be played by James Mason. So, if you've ever seen Taylor and these two, Taylor and Burton, in that movie, you can't imagine anybody else playing that. And then you're told Betty Davis and James Mason, two extraordinary actors, but you can't even imagine it. I don't know. So that blew me away. Also, Taylor was a babe at that point, but in the movie you wouldn't know it. And she was told by, I guess it would have been Mike Nichols, that he needed her to gain at least 20 pounds. And she happily did. So there was that. And I just blown away. Also, a little tidbit from that is that George and Martha are the first names of who? George Washington and Martha Washington. And yes, Edward Albee, the playwright, that is where he got the names for the two characters at the center of his play, George and Martha. Okay, here's another little tidbit. I just learned this morning. There are no tennis courts in Tibet. I have no reason why I would have known that, but I'm telling you, that's a true statement. There are no tennis courts in Tibet. And it's actually partly, first of all, it's not, whatever. It's partly because of the altitude. Tennis balls can explode on impact. I'm just saying. Isn't that a interesting little factoid? I was reading a story in the sports section about a guy who is a tennis player from Tibet, which in and of itself is unusual because there are no tennis courts in Tibet. And yet, he was first team all Ivy League. His name is, I can't pronounce his name, Top and he is ranked, albeit 869th in the world, but moving on up. And he, as a child, went to China to learn how to play tennis. He was really into it, even though you couldn't play where he lived. So it's a story. And another little factoid from that, when he came to the United States, he, you know, you have to have your name on passports and stuff. His first name, you try pronouncing this, F as in Frank, N as in nobody, U. His first name is FNU, Snoo. Turns out that's not really his first name. But in Tibet, not only don't they have tennis courts, but they don't follow a traditional first name, surname kind of way of identifying themselves or each other. So that I don't know what that means. I don't know what they use and how they, if they name each other anything, I don't know. But FNU is just something you write if you have to fill out a form asking for your first name when you're a Tibetan and you don't have one. And FNU stands for First Name Unknown. Isn't that wild? My dad didn't have a middle name, and I think, I can't remember where it was, but when he wanted to have a, if asked for an initial, middle initial, he put an N. His name was Norman Miller. So it would be Norman N. Miller. And I must have once asked, somebody asked him, what's the N stand for? And he said, none. So, first name unknown, and Norman Nunn Miller. Okay. Wait. Excuse me. And now, what else do I have here? Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, I love this. So, again, to names I can't pronounce. We go to India now. We're moving west. We're moving a little bit west here, slowly. And I'm going to, this guy, his name is M. Manikandan. Manikandan, I think. Turns out he is a director, movie director, and he does, he's very well known in India. And I guess he has a few homes. He has one little getaway in southern India, and it was there was a burglary there last month. And the burglars have not, are they still on the loose? What they took has not been recovered. They got away with gold and silver and cash. But here's the thing. A few days after the burglary, a small plastic bag appeared outside the gates of the house. And this plastic bag was stitched shut with thin sticks. And inside it was something wrapped in a white handkerchief. When all of that was pulled apart and the handkerchief opened up, inside was a medal. Actually, a very prestigious national award that the director had won 3 years ago for one of his films. And there was the medal and also a note. It said, "Sir, please forgive us. Your hard work belongs to you alone." So the guys that ripped him off, realizing they had this thing that was, well, for him, returned it. With an apology, please forgive us. Now, they didn't return the gold, silver, and other stuff they took, But somehow I was thinking, who, what's that phrase about honor among thieves? I mean, these guys, these burglars, exhibited more honor, more character, right? And a whole bunch of other people I can think of, including the thief in chief, Donald Trump, who never apologized to anyone for anything. You want thieves with honor? Here's thieves with honor. Just saying. I love that story. They're still looking for the guys. They couldn't get fingerprints. They got some fingerprints off the plastic bag, but it didn't lead them anywhere. So they're still at large. And I hope they don't catch them. Leave them alone. What they got away with was about $1,200. So that doesn't seem so outrageous. Oh. Okay, and just a little time I have remaining. Another Holocaust survivor dead, guys, and I got it. Sorry, you're gonna. She was 114, and she was raised in Pittsburgh. She didn't die here. Raised in Pittsburgh, known to be the oldest Jew in the world. The oldest Jew in the world has died, it says right here. She used to go when she was a little kid to Rodef Shalom, and she attended Shenley High School. Her name, Pearl Seinenberg Berg. She died in L.A. Did I say she was 114? I said she was 114! My God! The Gerontology Research Group, which verifies the birthdays of centenarians, recognized her as the oldest Jew in the world, the third oldest American, and the ninth oldest person in the world. And so there you have it. She was born in Evansville, Indiana. Her parents joined a traveling vaudeville show. They landed in New Orleans. What? They were trying to get to Detroit, but somehow ended up in Cleveland. And then in the 20s, they had settled in Pittsburgh. They lived on North Craig Street. I'm just saying, her dad, I'm looking at an ad from his used car company, Massey's Used Cars. This is an ad from 1924. Anyway, that's it. She is now gone. I think that's it for me. Happy whatever this is. Oh, yeah, President's Day. And I guess I'll be talking to you guys tomorrow with maybe Susan in tow. Blue skies. Enjoy. Bye-bye.
Lynn Cullen Live. Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and archived at pghcitypaper.com. The opinions expressed on Lynn Cullen Live are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of Pittsburgh City Paper or its advertisers.